Fear is gone. I'm at ease now. So very often I'm uncomfortable, but I'm at ease. Like everybody else, I was uncomfortable coming up here before the meeting. I get the butterflies, I get the jitters. But once I'm into doing what I'm doing, I can go ahead. I can feel at ease about it. But to get back to the main thrust of this thing, is that I reached this point where nothing was going to make any change in my life. And then this thing we talk about in the 12th step, where we seem to have some kind of experience that alters the inner workings, that alters us somewhere down deep so that we take a different course. Third day, I'm trying to go to sleep late at night in my own bedroom, dark. And I fell asleep for a little while, and I woke up complete and abject terror. I didn't know what was wrong. I had many experiences like that, as most of you know, at different times, terrors. But this was different. I didn't know what I was afraid of. I didn't have any idea what was happening. And I couldn't move, which was the worst part. I was actually immobile, like a piece of wood laying there, and I couldn't move. I couldn't think. I couldn't scream. I couldn't ask for help. And I saw a great, big, round glow of light ahead of me. It was like a big argent disc of hammered silver. You know what hammered silver looks like? And there were two big posts on each side with a caduceus around them and some steps. If you think I was afraid before, you can imagine how afraid I was then. Because now I knew they were going to get me, you know. For all these years, I've been able to stay out of those places. Now I know they're going to get me, you know. And a voice out of nowhere said, "Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid." I couldn't move. But as soon as it hit me, the impact hit me, I loosened up. And I wasn't afraid. And the voice told me what to do. And I said, "I can't do that. I can't do that." And the voice then said something to me that told me just how deep, whatever this was that was talking to me, how deeply it knew me. Because it laughed and it said, "You shyster, you." And I knew exactly what it meant. I was doing again what I'd always done. The indirect approach, the indirect answer, the indirect question, never face anything head on. My whole life, never faced anything head on. And I had to change. And I said, what can I do? And I was told what to do. And part of that's the reason this program, I'm not going to tell you the exact words, but part of that's the reason this program has come into existence. Because I was told what to do. And that was a profound experience to me, because for 24 hours I knew complete and absolute serenity. Complete serenity. I knew that everything is all right with the world. That half the time I only get in my own way. If I'm just follow directions according to my own conscience on the inside, that things will work out. I still forget it at times, but that's the way it's been most of the time. I've never forgotten one word of what happened. I could draw you a picture. I have drawn a picture of this. The only thing I can tell you is that that voice was the higher power, first higher power I really ever found, because I understood it. I understood what it was saying, and I understood where it was coming from. Somewhere deep inside of me where I'm connected to this universe, something came through, because I could never believe in the conceptual gods that most people have believed in. I saw so much difference in my family background. You know, from Catholicism to Presbyterianism and all the ways in between, it confuses a child, you know, when you have people that you know. And yet as a child, I always seemed to know there was something more for me. Now, when I was a very, very small kid, I always run around with older people. Now, I'm not talking about at 7 years old, I'm running around with kids 9 years old. I associated with men 60 and 70 years old. They were the people I liked to be with because they had interesting things to tell me and interesting things to show me. The one man I made great friends with was over 70. He was an explorer, an archaeologist, and an ornithologist. And I used to watch all the things that he had collected and all his travels over the years. And I was so interested in these things. I wanted to do them too. And my other very, very close friend was the town drunk. And he was a great guy, you know. He was so good to me in so many ways. And he was such a louse on another, so many others, you know. And he used to fall down the stairs and break himself open and break his leg. Break his head open and the blood would be running down 2-3 flights of stairs, you know. And one time when I'm about 7 1/2, he fell down the stairs and I found him and the blood was running down 3 flights of the concrete steps, you know. I found him, I went running in to get my mother. We got him into a hospital and I used to keep saying to her, when can we see Mr. Cruikshank? She said, next week. This kept going on. Finally, I said, I have to see him. She said, all right. So she took us up to a place called Craw Road. Which means Craw Road. This was the nut house. We're up in this beautiful grounds of this nut house. And here he is sitting in a chair, a wheelchair. And he's just staring straight ahead. He can't see me, and I couldn't understand why he couldn't see me, why he couldn't talk to me. I said, what is wrong with him? She said, he's a sick man. I said, what do you mean sick? She says he drank too much and got hurt too much over the years. And I didn't say anything after that. They took him away. As we were walking down the big pathway down to get the trolley car to go home, she said, why are you so quiet? I said, well, I'll tell you. When I grow up, I'm going to help people like Mr. Cruikshank. I've never forgotten that, because I wondered at that time what I meant. So you see, the course was laid out for me. I had to become an alcoholic and an addict to fulfill my destiny. I went to school. I went to a prep school in Pennsylvania to study for the ministry, thinking that was one of the ways I had to go. Well, I lasted there about 3 years, you know. I couldn't make it. I stole all the wine I could get my hands on. We had 17 altars down one side, you know, and 3 in the front. And half the time there was just barely enough wine left for the priest to say Mass, you know. And of course, you know the job I had, you know. I worked in the sacristy, naturally. So after they found out about that, then I went down the cellar and found out how to get in the wine cellar. Snake the stuff out from underneath, you know. Push the dirt back again so they couldn't see where it went. Then after that, I got a job as what we called, can't remember the name of it now, but it was taking care of the good father's rooms, cleaning up, you know, getting their books, drinking their whiskey is what it was, really, you know. Because I could go to 6 or 7 rooms in the morning and I'd feel pretty good by first class time, you know. Then I wouldn't have to go over the wall that night and go down to the village. And by the way, in that village, which is back in Pennsylvania, we've got 2 NA meetings going right now. Okay? One's called the Cornwell Heights meeting, and that's where I went to school. Most of my buddies there that continued their studies all became the kind of people that I had wished in years gone by that I could become. They're professors. They're past presidents of a university. All of them. You know? The ones that are not dead. And here I am. I met one of them not too long ago. He's a member of AA. I met him after 26 years in Africa as a missionary. I met him right here in San Fernando Valley. He's got 15 years on the program, but that's 18 years now. Yeah. Our paths cross, you know. So maybe I haven't said too much. I don't even know what time it is or how long this is supposed to last. Is there going to be a dance after this, Frakus? Okay, then. I'm going to wind this up pretty soon. And perhaps I can come back some other time. But I just would like to say a few things about H&I committees, but how difficult it was. You see, I used to say many years ago, and I know Bob and probably some of the others here, remember, I used to say, I believe that this program will work best from the inside out. I think if we can carry the message to the inside, and these people grasp it there and come out, This will really make it grow. I found out I was wrong. It didn't really grow much from the outside in either, you know, until recently. But I remember some of the first contacts we had with officials. I remember the very first time we ever tried to carry the message of NA into an institution. We tried to carry it into Max up at the Castaic, and after the first meeting, we were asked not to come back. The one guy that was leading the meeting, he took up all the time, and all he did was talk down to the people that were in there, you know. And they didn't like it, and neither did the people in the institution, so they asked, please don't come back. Which was all right, we were learning, you know. The next time, we went down to TI with another guy, and one of the people in the back row at that time, sitting back there, and we could hear him. He was making all the usual wisecracks, and turned out about a year later, he walked into a meeting over in on War Park at the church, and Bob remembers him. Old hip slick Phil, whose story is in the little white book, he walked in there, and we tricked him there too, you know. And then he told us how well he was doing in the H&I committee in AA, and that he really didn't need this Narcotics Anonymous bit, you know. And I asked him after the meeting, I said, are you going to come back to some more meetings? He said, well, I don't think so. No, he said, I'm too busy doing the things I like to do where I am, you know, going into the institutions and carrying the message. I said, well, we need the message carried too, you know. And he said, well, I don't know. Well, naturally, I had to hook him in, you know, because I'm still not as straightforward maybe as I'd like to be. See? So I said, well, that's too bad, because I was going to ask you to leave the meeting next Friday night. And, of course, he took the bait, you know, and he was back the next Friday night with some of his friends, and we had a good meeting. And he continued to come back. So I don't care how we get people into the program, as long as they come and they want what we have. See, there are times when I feel that I'm not making contact with newcomers enough. My higher power works kind of funny with me. See? Generally, when I ask for a newcomer, I ask this way for me. I say, I want somebody for a little while that wants this program. I don't care if they only want it for today, for tonight, for 2 hours. I just want them to want it for a little while. See? Because that's the desire. It can be increased. It can be built on. It can be drawn out. See? You know, within anywhere from 24 minutes to 24 hours, I always get somebody brand new. Strange the way the higher power works. It's always somebody either calls, walk into in strange places, you know, run into them in men's rooms, walk into them in restaurants, you know, stop to get an ice cream cone someplace and walk into somebody and introduce them to the program. That's planting the seed, you know. I think one of the things that I continue to do probably is just to give myself as completely as I can to this program, because it is my whole life. It doesn't mean that I don't have many other things to do. I don't have enough time to do everything I want to do. I sometimes wonder if all of us got together and asked our higher collective higher power to make the days 48 hours long and the weeks 23 days long, that maybe we could catch up with ourselves. Yeah? But I doubt if that'll ever happen. So the only other way I can do that probably is to live to be like 250. So I've said before that to people who come through this program and that I meet at meetings, I'm going to be around here for a long, long time. So you're going to have to put up with me, because I'm not going to leave. But I hope that you hang around too, because maybe, if we all stick together, we will find unity in this program. We will learn how to apply the traditions, which is the only thing that will make the fellowship grow. And we will be able to carry the message to every corner of the earth. Whether it's in an institution here, or in Bangkok, or in Thailand, in Scotland, in Poland. By the way, we're behind the Iron Curtain now. We've got two meetings in Poland. You'd be surprised what's going on. There's a Catholic priest down in Brazil I translated a little part of the white book, and I'm trying to get in touch with them. I've called them a number of times. I can't reach anybody down there, so I've had to write to them. There's more calls for help coming in from different parts of the world than ever has before. We need everybody. We don't need just a few people. Every member of Narcotics Anonymous is needed in some way. None of us have it made. That's the unfortunate thing that happens to us so often. We think we have it made. We can't all give all our time, but we can be the program, because you are the program. You're the only program that some people will ever see, whether in or out of an institution. And what's your image? Is it false or is it real? You know, sometimes I'm so doggone much off the wall that I couldn't get serious if I tried. Tonight I just happen to be serious, because I realize more than ever when I look around a room like this, there's so many people. And I remember the times we used to sit with two and three of us around the table at the only meeting in the entire world. I remember one time Bob said to me, he said, "Well, what did we have to do all that other stuff for?" This was after he got out to hatch people last time, by the way. He still has a little resentment towards me, you know. Because I wrote to him when he was up in Tehachapi and answered his letter, and I sent him up a starter kit and said, "Get a meeting started," and I didn't enclose any money for him. Right, Bob? He didn't need any money. What did he need money for? Get in trouble? He was in enough trouble as it was, you know. Yeah. Remember, a lot of times we had to do that. And he said, "Well, what do we need all this stuff for?" I said, "Because one of these days there's going to be a lot of kids that are not born yet. They're going to need what we have to offer. Thank God we have what we have to offer." Not just new people, but the kids of the members who weren't even born at that time. We've got something to offer the world. I wish I could remember the thing I wrote this afternoon on that last page that I was going to wind up this talk with. I can maybe give it to you, not in the verse that it's written in, but maybe I can give it to you in essence. And I was thinking, you know, if there was ever an epitaph that I would like to see on my headstone, if I have a headstone, I'll probably be buried at sea, though. If there's ever an epitaph written, it might go something like this. All we did was sow some seeds and worked and wrought to make this work so that we and others might live in peace, in freedom, and in love.
Thanks a lot, Jimmy. Yeah, right. I'd like to make amends to you people if you think I was a little bit too heavy-handed tonight. Maybe I was, you know, but the meeting is anyway going to end on time. It started on time and it's ending on time. That's all the purpose that I serve tonight, you know? Ladies and gentlemen, there's going to be a dance that follows this meeting. We're going to need help cleaning the room up, stacking the chairs, picking up the ashtrays and the cups and whatever. And if everybody picks up whatever they left behind, we'll get the boogie that much faster. So let's all get together and end this meeting in the usual manner, okay? Where I come from, we usually end the meeting in, with the Lord's Prayer.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And we all hold hands.
Here's